I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is novelist, essayist, and short story writer Mary Gaitskill. She's joined in conversation by Zoetrope All-Story editor Michael Ray. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Mary Gaitskill and Michael Ray.
No writer is sharper about the fickle exigencies of desire than Mary Gaitskill. Dominance and submission, the shifting poles that govern all relationships, not just sexual ones, are Gaitskill's great subjects, carrying her from her breakout 1988 collection, Bad Behavior, to her novels, Two Girls, Fat and Thin, Veronica, and The Mare, through two more story collections, Because They Wanted To and Don't Cry. Her latest is Somebody with a Little Hammer, a new collection of essays dating from 1994 to 2016. She writes, quote, "In case you don't know, I'm supposedly sick and dark." But as Saraya Dorbin recently wrote in the LA Review of Books, it should be obvious that she is neither one nor the other, that she is in fact a voice of reason and sanity, of piercing intelligence and generous humanity. Appearing in conversation with Mary this evening is Michael Ray, longtime editor of Zoetrope All Story, a short story and art quarterly founded by Francis Ford Coppola. Let's give them a warm welcome.
Thank you.
So it's a treat for you to be here, and I always look forward to having a chance to see you whenever you come through town. And in preparing for this conversation and reading the collection, I'd started reading and sort of had a notepad next to me where I was documenting questions. And when I was done, I found I had like just 10 pages of these like amazing, brilliant lines and passages and no questions yet. So you have an immense gift for these just really kind of searing insights that every time I read your work, even reading it a second time, is still startling. But I was curious about how your approach to writing fiction differs from your approach to writing nonfiction, and how they might be similar.
That's actually a question I can answer, but before I do that, sorry about my voice. I'm recovering from kind of a bad cold or something. So my voice is rumpled up. I wish it wasn't, but I can't help it. Also I wanted to say that's happened to me a lot. Like when I interviewed Yi-Yun Lee at the New York Public Library a few months ago, that's what happened to me with her book. I was like underlining things crazily and checking them and circling them. And I did come up with questions eventually, but I've had exactly the same experience. But it's totally different, fiction and nonfiction. Like nonfiction, even if it's kind of a complicated thing, even if it's more of like a memoir, there's a few in there that I would call memoirs. It's basically you know what happened, and you're saying what happened. You're saying what happened, what you thought about it, what you felt about it, what you imagined somebody else thought and felt about it, and remembering as best you can what the other people involved said. It's pretty simple, really. It's not that it's easy, but it's you're starting from one point and going to the other. There's a lot of points that might branch out, but nonetheless, that's what it is. If it's an argumentative piece like The Trouble with Following the Rules, then it's going to be like, here's what I want to convince people of. I mean, I'm a little bit loopy about that because I always like to start out with some kind of thesis that's actually not what I believe at all. But it's like something that's like a dominant opinion, and I'll usually lay that out like I believe it, and then I'll start picking it apart. So at the end, I've been in a completely different place, which has its drawbacks because a lot of people I've realized do not get off what you first said. They won't forget it. They'll think that that's what you mean, even if you wind up in a completely different place. But whatever, that's what I do. And it's like, okay, here's what I believe. Here's what I'm trying to convince the reader of, and I'm going to lay it out. It may be complicated, but I'm going to wind up where I want to wind up. Fiction's not like that at all. Even if it's about something that actually happened, it's a far less rational process. It's things come into it kind of from all sides, and it's not about here I am and I want to get there. Sometimes in fiction I get the ending first, and I don't know what the story is even. It's just a picture I've got at the end. This book that I'm supposed to be working on, and which I may never finish, came to me in the form of people as weather, like I pictured the weather as human beings. I had no idea what that had to do with the thing, but that's how I started it. And eventually I realized what it did have to do with it. The title of it is The End of Seasons. But I didn't know that when I first got that imagery. When I started to write The Mare, I actually didn't want to write it. I thought it was a stupid idea. But I kept getting these pictures that would just come, just kind of bloom in my mind out of nowhere. It wasn't like an argument at all, and I wound up, and often with I write fiction, I wind up in a really different place than I thought. So it's just a completely different process. And I find writing essays much easier. Though I wouldn't call it easy, but it's easier than fiction.
Yeah, and in that way, do you find that they're complementary in a way? Like it's sort of, as you've been working on a fictional project for a long time, are you kind of more open to, say, like some sort of security or some sort of set end game with a nonfiction piece?
What was the question?
Was that too complicated? Sorry. But just curious if they're complementary in a certain way. That, I mean, because they are such different experiences in writing, that if you're deep into a novel, like, do you feel like writing a nonfiction piece can be some sort of release because at least you sort of, you're approaching the work in a different way?
I don't think I've ever thought about it. It could be, perhaps, like a kind of palate cleanser. But I've never really thought about it one way or the other.
And I know that, a lot of people would draw some sort of shared origins between The Mare and Lost Cat. And obviously, they're different characters. But
they're connected, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, when you have an idea for something, is there a process where does it seem naturally kind of to lend itself to fiction or nonfiction? Because that's one where it seems like you explored an idea both as in a fictional novel and then also in this essay.
Well, when I wrote Lost Cat, do you guys know what we're talking about? I feel kind of strange if you haven't read any of this. The Mare is about, it's a novel about a young girl from East New York, which is a rough area of Brooklyn, who comes upstate to New York, up in the country, through a charitable organization called the Fresh Air Fund, and she learns to ride, is introduced to a stable next to her host family. The charitable organization is based on a real thing called the Fresh Air Fund, which is a really weird organization, actually. But it takes children from the inner city who are almost always Latino or African American, though not always. Jonathan Lethem was a Fresh Air Fund kid. And it almost always places them with host families who are white, though again, not always, but generally speaking. And it's a strange kind of culture clash. But anyway, this girl is one of those kids, and she goes up and stays with this kind of neurotic couple, or at least the woman is kind of neurotic. And they introduce her to horses, and that's basically what the story is about, her learning to ride and also the conflict between what she's experiencing upstate and what she is experiencing at home and how she really has to struggle to put that together, and her loyalty to her mother versus her affection for the woman upstate and how they clash with each other, not the women so much as the girl's feelings. And Lost Cat was something that started out to be actually much more simple than it turned out to be. I wrote it almost, I don't write for therapy most of the time, but sometimes I do. And it was about losing this kitten that I had rescued in Italy and brought back to home with me. And he was sick. He was blind in one eye, and I had kind of nurtured him back to health, and he got lost, and I went completely crazy. I was just kind of unbelievably heartbroken about it. I don't cry very much, and I was just crying all day sometimes about this poor little cat. And it was a lot of it. It was just really, I really did love the cat, and I didn't know what happened to him, and I was afraid he was suffering. But it was, I realized it was connected to other things. And so when I started to write the essay just to make sense out of this tornado of grief that was tearing through me, and I realized it was connected to children that I really had been involved with through the Fresh Air Fund, not just a girl, but a boy as well. The boy really more than the girl at first. And also just things I was realizing about my family just turned into this kind of monstrous epic of misery. But yes, that was, they're certainly connected. But when I wrote Lost Cat, I was not thinking I was going to write a novel. Like I said, when I conceived of it, I thought it was a stupid idea.
And I was curious, I mean, I had mentioned to you that, because Lost Cat is about, as I read it, you know, so much more than losing the cat. I mean, I think the cat, losing the cat becomes a doorway through which all these other feelings also pour. And it's about your relationship with your father and the relationship with these kids. And when I'd encountered the essay, the first time when it came out in Granta, which I think was 2009, I was a new parent at the time, and I had a, I guess I had a one-year-old, and I think that my parental anxieties were pretty blunt. I mean, it was, you know, making sure the kids survived the day. And then reading this collection now, having three kids between the ages of 5 and 9, and kind of the understanding them more as people, getting accustomed to this idea of parenting that where you can't control it. There was a line in there about parenting that I felt like was one of the most salient things I'd ever read, which was, I act almost blindly and hope most of it will be to the good. And that totally captured my experience of parenting. But that was, I mean, it's just such an epic essay. It's one that I think about a lot. I mean, you started just writing about the cat. So you wrote your way into realizing, making the connection to your father and your relationship with your sisters, and then also with Caesar and Natalia, the two kids from the Fresh Air Fund. In that way, did it become more kind of like fiction, where you just start on like an idea and then the process of writing kind of takes you into understanding something in your life better?
No, because that happens when you write nonfiction too sometimes, but it was closer. That particular essay is definitely closer to the process of writing fiction than some of the other ones, because it was a memoir. It wasn't an argument or trying to convince anybody of anything. Although part of it was, I was also trying to understand the idea of what level of grief is appropriate. Is it, one part of me thought it was kind of crazy. I mean, I've had cats before. I love cats. I really like them as animals, and particular cats I love more than others. It's sad when you lose a pet. But I couldn't understand the degree to which I was just heartbroken over this animal, and I felt ridiculous almost. But so I was trying to think, well, what is appropriate grief though? Like who decides this? What is big and what's little? Like I started the essay, but I had had a conversation with one of my sisters before. I had the experience of losing the cat, and she was really upset because my other sister was really upset about her cat. She my other sister Jane. I named both of them in the essay, and she had two children, and her life was really difficult at the time. She had to take care of her sister-in-law's orphan children. Her sister-in-law died of cancer. She also had to take care of her mother-in-law a lot of the time, and she's physically not well. Neither one of my sisters are well. And so she was in physical pain and had all this stuff going on. But it's when her cat had to be put down that she just went to pieces. And my other sister, Martha, was really angry at her because they just get into these weird arguments. And Jane wasn't going to put the cat down, even though the cat was suffering and obviously sick. And Martha was really upset and emailing me and saying, it's selfish of her. She should put the cat down. It's harder on her children and blah, blah, blah. And I just got really irritated with Martha, and I said, look, Martha, trust Jane to make the right decision. It's her cat. And Martha was using the word tragedy a lot, and I said, this is not a tragedy. The tragedy is the war in Iraq. It's Hurricane Katrina. It's the earthquake in China. It's not an old cat dying of old age. Pull yourself together. But then actually after I said that, I went and looked up the word in the dictionary, and I was wrong. Tragedy, apparently, according to this dictionary, it was the secondary definition, but it was anything pathetic or melancholy or sad. So I emailed her back, and I said, I'm sorry, I was wrong, but but I still think you're being a nut. So that was like before all of this, but I thought back to that. As I thought, like, who decides? And I also thought, you know, to that little animal, if he's out there dying slowly and painfully, he doesn't know. He's an animal. He doesn't know what the word tragedy is. Although I also thought animals probably accept whatever's happening to them way easier than we do, because they don't have very many ideas about what ought to be happening. So I was trying to deal with all of that, too. Like, it connected with the relationship I had with those children, because my husband the whole time was saying, you know, this is inappropriate. It's just so inappropriate. You're in a different culture, and you're acting like a white savior, and you're doing this because you feel guilty. And all of that may have been true, but I also really loved them. They were adorable. And I felt a very strong affinity for them, which I just couldn't distrust. But at the same time, you know, I could see what he was saying, and so it was a scary thing, and I was trying to deal with that too. Like, who decides what's appropriate? How do you decide this? Like, all those things he mentioned were certainly commonsensical things. But what does that have to do with why somebody moves you? It doesn't. I mean, the boy at one point, he was like 7, he looked at me point blank, and he goes, we're going back on the train. He goes, you like me? And I was like, are you kidding me? I love you. And he said, why? He's a really smart kid. I could have said, because you asked that question. but I said, you know, I don't know. I don't know yet. Sometimes you love people and you don't know why, but I can tell you something. I will know one day, and I'll tell you then. And I did. I was able to go back maybe 3 years later. I was able to go back to that conversation and say, remember you asked me that? It was because of the way you're talking right now. And I could tell that when you were 6 years old. So anyway, it was kind of about that too. But yeah, it was really hard because all these social reasons they did eventually make it really hard to have a relationship. I still know them. But I can't be as close to them now as I was when they were kids, because they have these strong social identities that are hard to put together with me. So yeah, I mean, my husband wasn't wrong, but I wasn't either.
And did they ever... I think you'd said you'd given a copy of The Mare to Natalia, but did the kids ever read that essay?
I don't know, because they were pretty young when it first came out. I think they have read it, though, because they look online. And when I called her to tell her that I... actually, there was an article in Vogue that I wrote about learning to write in which I mentioned her. So I called her to talk about it with her. It was before the book came out. She knew I was working on the book. I told her about that. But I was saying that the magazine might want to fact check some things with you. Is that okay? And she goes, I know all about it already, Mary. And I'm like, you can't. I haven't published it yet. She goes, yeah, but I looked online. I read about it. I'm like, I don't know what she's talking about. But my guess is it was Lost Cat. But I don't know. I didn't ask her. Her life is so complicated. I didn't want to get into a big discussion of it right then.
And so you are still in touch with them? You said to some extent that the relationship isn't what it used to be. I mean, I thought, like, one of the more fascinating characters, I mean, a character, a real person in that essay to me, was the mother, or their mother. I mean, there was a moment where I guess you'd sent the kids to camp, and then you'd shown their mother photos. I guess it was of Natalia, shown her photos at camp of kind of being happy, and the mother had thrown
them on the ground. She literally dropped them on the floor. I was like, here, because they were pictures not only of her happy, but her succeeding at something, because she was always telling her she was a failure at anything. And so I showed her these pictures, and I thought she might react, and she looked at them, just went like that, and literally dropped them on the floor.
Do you think that there was, did she perceive some sort of judgment from you, kind of like that you could deliver some happiness to the
kids? It's possible. I mean, I could forgive her quite a bit because I just felt like I didn't know where she was coming from so much, but that did piss me off, I have to say. Because it was in front of the girl. Or just, it was incomprehensible to me. It was almost like I couldn't even react to it with anger, even though I've seen it before. It's not the first time I've seen that kind of behavior, certainly. I think I just picked them up and handed them to the girl.
You're listening to novelist, essayist, and short story writer Mary Gateskill, whose latest book is Somebody with a Little Hammer. She's joined in conversation by Zoetrope All-Story editor Michael Ray on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I mean, my mother does something similar, and she's had similar experiences of conflict with parents, and I feel like she has spent as much time trying to sort of nurture her relationships with the parent as to some extent as much with the kids, just to show that, I don't know, not to be perceived as someone who's kind of coming in as a savior, thinking that right. She knows more than anybody else, but just she has, I think in a lot of these homes, it's really just a question of like, who has the time and patience to pay attention to these kids. And I think, I mean, it seemed like their mother was, you know, run pretty ragged.
Time, yeah. And she was not young. She was an older woman. She was about my age. She had 4 other children already in the DR. But yeah, I mean, that's part of why I could forgive her a lot, because I'm sure she thought I was an idiot a lot of the time, or just some incomprehensible person. But at the same time, I mean, I think she did appreciate that I was there. I mean, she did say several times, I trust you with my children. But I think she had mixed feelings, but I understood that.
So sort of on a different topic, I'd happened across a review of this collection with a particularly odious title. I don't know if you read it. It was in Book Forum. It was Hammer Time.
I looked at it. I don't remember the title.
Yeah, Hammer Time. But it, what did it call?
Hammer Time?
Hammer Time
oh,
was
no,
the
I
name of the review. Yeah.
I think that's great. Sasha
Are you Fair
kidding
Jones.
Me? I love that.
But what had occurred to me, especially in these essays, was like how amazing, like how awesome the titles are. I mean, like for the review of the Joyce Carol Oates' The Blonde book, Die Hard, D-Y-E.
That was Book Forum's title.
Oh, is that really? That
I
was
left
a good
it.
That was really
no,
good.
I
mean, the revelations, a lot of exploding heads is
that
an
was
amazing.
Mine.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the titles are mine, but if the title was good, I kept it.
But, and maybe it's, I don't know. I don't know that there's a process question there, but I feel like you write great titles.
Thank you.
I mean, maybe there's something there in sort of the clarity, but I always loved there's that the story that we'd published of yours, The Arms and Legs of the Lake, which I always thought was a really powerful title. And I mean, with the nonfiction stuff, how do you choose your subjects? I mean, I think that there's obviously some stuff that you might be just doing for money or for whatever, but I mean, are there ideas that just sort of sit with you for a while, especially for kind of like some of the memoir stuff? Like, how do you kind of, where do the ideas start?
Well, some of it, as you said, is just for money. But I have to have some degree of interest in it. There are things I've actually said no to, even though I was desperate for money. Once, back in the 90s, late 90s, somebody called me from the New York Times Style magazine. And even she was embarrassed. It wasn't her idea. It was Adam Moss's idea, apparently. And she said they wanted me, or the writer of this piece, to write as if she was getting ready to go to a party. And as she was choosing her outfit, to coldly and almost cruelly analyze her body parts. And I was like, are you kidding me? She was like, I know it's kind of weird, but it's Adam thinks it's a good idea. I'd be happy to do it for Adam. I could coldly and cruelly analyze his body
his body parts.
He wants. Like, really, the women of America don't have enough problems already? But I said no to that, and I did, and I needed the money. But I looked at, because I wondered, did they get anybody to do this? Who would do that? But, yeah, some of the things I did write just because somebody offered me some money. But some of them I wrote because I really wanted to write them, like the piece on not following the rules or the date, what's called the date rape piece. I was so passionate about that, it got rejected everywhere. Like, I wrote it and I sent it literally everywhere. Nobody wanted it. Finally, somebody at Harper's had lunch with somebody who mentioned it to him, and he was like, maybe we should look at that. And, yeah, that one. And the one about the political adultery, like, I was so sick of hearing the wives of, like, Elliot Spitzer and Jonathan Edwards, poor Mrs. Edwards, my God, yeah. Hillary Clinton, just constantly being described as humiliated. Oh, she's so humiliated. It's so humiliating. How can she withstand this humiliation? It's just, like, ridiculous. Like, over and over again, and we're so terrible. She's just so humiliated. I'm so sorry because she's just so humiliated. Are you, like... But so that's why I wrote that one. I was just like getting so pissed off. Like I called it Leave the Woman Alone.
Yeah. Another like, great title.
It used to be like the mistress used to be castigated publicly, and now you're going after the wife. So that one, and also, gosh, I'm not remembering. But there was, Linda Lovelace. I always knew who Linda Lovelace was. I saw Deep Throat in the 70s when it came out. I heard, you know, she'd written this book about how she was raped while she was making the movie, and I kind of thought it was vaguely ridiculous and didn't think any more about it. And then I went out with some guy, 2012, who was had been involved. He was good friends with Chuck Traynor and, like, went on this rant about what a stupid liar she was. And I was just like, God, what's wrong with you? Why would you? She's dead. Why do you care that much? And it made me, like, investigate her more, and I just, I felt it was such a tragic, I mean, really, I will use that word, tragic story, and I really cared passionately about writing something about her. I don't know how many people have suffered as much as I think she did, whether she's was raped, drinking Deep Throat or not. And there were a couple other pieces like that I just wrote them because I really cared about them, and I didn't care if I found a place mm-hmm. to publish them or not. Lost Cat was one of them. I didn't know if anyone would publish that. It was interminable. 52 pages of agony. I mean, I'd picture the cat reading it and going... At first, like, oh, this is great. She really loved me. She cared. And, all right, this is enough. And now she's talking about her dad. Get over it, woman. Go outside. Do something else. But anyway, yeah. So they were different. But even the ones I wrote for money, for them to be good, I had to get into them.
And for the collection, I mean, these are pieces that are spanning more than two decades. And I was curious just sort of for the going back and re-encountering each of these pieces. Like, I mean, I assume that you hadn't read these in some time since you'd written them. So did you have different perspectives on them now and kind of what your arguments were at the time looking back? And I was thinking specifically because of, you know, rewriting the end of the rules essay.
Yeah, I did somewhat. I mean, if it was really different, like there were some that I didn't include because I just wasn't really behind them anymore. Also stylistically, sometimes, like there was a certain point when I first started writing these things, I was very, very earnest. And at a certain point, it was like I realized I could be clever. And I started writing almost a little too cute or a little too, I don't know what the word is, smartass. And I didn't like those so much. Even if I liked the content, I didn't like the tone. So I didn't include those. But yeah, even the ones that wound up in the book, I didn't rewrite very many of them. And I didn't rewrite. I didn't want to go so far as to feel I was cheating. So when I did rewrite the mm-hmm. end of that one, I announced that I was, here's what I originally wrote, and here's what I think now. But yeah, some of them, like I thought that the end of that, which was about the piece I wrote about date rape, which was a huge topic in the 90s. It was like suddenly everybody was talking, was somebody was, whole definition of what rape is. And it was a funny thing because when I first heard the conversation, I would turn on the radio and there'd be people talking about date rape and the horror of date rape. And my first reaction was, I was in my 30s and I just said, what the hell is this? How could you say you were raped if you didn't fight the guy? Or at least say you didn't want, if you didn't say you didn't want it clearly, how could you possibly say you were raped? That's idiotic. So I was kind of on the Camille Paglia side at first. But then I remembered that it had happened to me, that I was in a situation where I was young. I was 16, and I was really high. I was on acid, which I don't know how many of you have done that drug. It's a very powerful drug. It's hard to talk out sometimes. And I had been in situations, even at that time, where I had been very aggressive, and I'd been able to talk my way out of it. I was a good talker at that age. But I got not on acid. And also, I was in inner city of Detroit, and he was older. I don't know how old he was. He may have been 35. He may have only been 25. But he was a black guy, and it was a very rough area. And it was complicated for that reason, because I could, as ignorant as I was, I could tell his life had been much different than mine. And it was like this really, really complicated mixture of power and vulnerability and privilege that was kind of back and forth. I mean, he was way bigger than me, and I remember he said something. I said at one point there was a silence, and he moved right next to me, and I said, what are you thinking, in an inept way? And he said, I'm thinking if I wasn't such a nice guy, you'd really be getting screwed right now. And I just took that as a threat, and I don't know if it really was. I wish I'd said, what do you mean by that? Or could you just sit back a little further or something like that? But I was just scared. So, and I was afraid if I did resist him, it could get really ugly. And it was really sad because I don't think he would have actually raped me, but I don't know. Because I think that because he wasn't physically rough at all. I mean, I don't know why he even wanted to do it. Maybe he didn't actually do acid because it's not a very... Anyway, am I going too far off
the topic? No, not at all.
But anyway, I remembered that experience, and I remember how confused I was about it because it was horrible. I mean, if you don't want to have sex and you're on acid and somebody's... And also, I'd barely done it at all. It was like a really horrible experience physically. But at the same time, I didn't... He obviously really wanted me to be excited, and he was being romantic in a way. It makes me sad even to think about it now. But I didn't, I just didn't know what to do with the experience at all. So afterwards I described it as being raped. I wouldn't have gotten him in any trouble. I was out of Detroit by then and it didn't affect him at all. But in a way it did affect things because I would say I was raped by this guy in Detroit and the people would say, black guy? And I would say, yeah. And I didn't have to say anything else. I mean, that was just automatically, they had a story in their head. So it was harmful, even if not to him personally. And I eventually stopped telling the story, but I remembered it suddenly, like I'd forgotten it. And I remembered it when that whole date rape conversation was going on. And I was thinking, why did I lie about that? And it was because I was too confused about what actually it was. And I still didn't really know what it was. I still don't know what would have happened if I'd said, I don't want to do this. You have to leave. So I just wanted to, that seemed like nobody was talking about that. There's something that can happen that isn't, it's not rape, but it's a bad experience. Like, and I don't know how relevant this is. Like I was on a panel last year about Title IX at universities. Like they're trying to say, they're to define these things so rigidly, and I was supposed to be part of somebody coming up with an answer. There's also a couple lawyers on this panel. I do not have an answer to that question, except maybe that a new word ought to be invented because there's a lot of bad things that can happen sexually that are not rape. There's a lot of ways to hurt people that are not actually rape. So I'm not sure if it would help anything to come up with a new word, but it seems like people are trying to define things so much now, and it's good, better than what happened in the past where women could be raped and actually beaten and nobody would believe them. But it's like gone kind of too far the other way on college campuses anyway. I'm sure it does happen now still, though, that women get raped and beaten and nobody believes them. I'm sure it still happens the old-fashioned way, too.
You know, I was also thinking about a memoir or an essay that we were lucky enough to publish, The Bridge, which is about attending a writer's conference in St. Petersburg. And you recall in the course of it that your initial desire to become a writer stemmed from, I think, being like 10 years old and reading the magazine Soviet Life.
Oh, I didn't say that.
Then the essay.
I did not say that. I wanted to be a writer earlier than that.
Earlier than 10.
But I did.
But you, oh, sorry. But you were thinking at the time.
I wanted to go to Russia.
You wanted to go to Russia and be a spy and be a writer. And there was this this amazing passage that I've always remembered, because, I mean, that was, I think he'd written that essay, was it 10 years ago or so? I mean, it was a while ago that was in the magazine. And you'd written, if you'll allow me to read a little bit of this, if somebody had told me when I was 10 that I would grow up to be a writer, that I would be invited to read in Russia, and that a Beatle would be playing a few blocks away, it would have made my life worth living. Now that it had all happened, I was simply put out by the lack of toilet seats and paper, the Giardia and the water supply, and the animals starving in the streets because people put out their pets when they couldn't afford to feed them anymore. And I wonder, sort of, as someone who wanted to be a writer from a very early age, how are the realities of being a writer as an adult, how are they different from kind of how you imagined the life would be?
Well, I think that passage reveals what a bad traveler I am. I have an unfortunate tendency to focus on small, irritating things. And not appreciate the larger, beautiful things. But yeah, that was a strange experience. It was Paul McCartney. He was playing it, and you could hear it, like, everywhere in the streets. It is different, but I remember when I was younger. I don't know if I was a teenager, I had much of an idea about what being a writer was like, but when I really started to think about it seriously in my early 20s, I pictured something incredibly glamorous, yet dignified. Something where people, like, were really playful and delightful and fun, but at the same time incredibly serious. And I remember having this fantasy, which in retrospect seems like an incredibly ridiculously modest fantasy, but it wasn't. Whereas I was picturing myself, it was just a picture. Like, sometimes I have fantasies that aren't fully played out fantasies, they're just kind of images. And it was like a picture of Norman Mailer. And Gore Vidal.
Yeah, Gore Vidal, yeah.
And it was a conference, and they were foregrounded, holding forth. And I was in the background looking down. That was my fantasy. And it sounds absurdly modest, except I don't really think it was. I mean, firstly, that was the limits of my imagination at that time, but also sometimes the person in the background looking down is actually more interesting than the loudmouths in the front. And I think I knew that even then. But not that it's prevented me from becoming a loud mouth, but that's kind of how I pictured it, like this really serious, sedate thing. And yet that was back in time where Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer were like on the Dick Cavett show, like actually practically fighting with each other. They actually fought each other in the dressing room about feminism. They were like on stage arguing. Women were screaming at Norman Mailer. I mean, there was that. It was that intense then, and so that's kind of what I pictured. I didn't picture what it is now, really, and I don't think I'm very good at what it is now, socially anyway. But it's okay.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features novelist, essayist, and short story writer Mary Gaitskill, whose latest book is Somebody with a Little Hammer. She's joined in conversation by Zoetrope all-story editor Michael Ray. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, I feel like it's been an experience, encountering people whose careers artistically I admire and think, if I'd achieved what you'd achieved, I would feel like I'd kind of made it. And for so many people that I meet, for whom I have that experience looking from the outside, you know, the more you get to know them, the more you realize that they're still, some level of dissatisfaction or frustration with where they're at. And so then I wonder if it's just that the people who are kind of driven by that kind of unachievable ambition and sort of a fundamental dissatisfaction, if that's sort of a necessary thing to make art.
I hope not.
They can be happy and do it.
I would hope so. I mean, I think writers can have kind of unfortunate personality traits. No, really, I'm not kidding. I think writers can be way too in their heads, way too introverted, way too tend to be melancholy. Not everybody, and not all the time. But yeah, I think writers can be dissatisfied, or just focus on things that aren't right, which in a way is, I suppose, drives you to some extent because it makes you want to unwind the thing and explore it, which can make a good story sometimes. But it also can be kind of unpleasant. But I don't think all writers are like that. I don't think Vladimir Nabokov is like that. Seems to be an abnormally happy person, to have been an abnormally happy person. John Updike, same thing, crazy happy. So, not everybody.
Well, there was, speaking of Mailer, there was a line in... your essay, This Doughty Nose, about Mailer, in which you described him as, you described his need to dominate and to be loved, especially to be loved by those whom he dominates, which was one of many moments in these essays that had seemed sort of politically prescient to me. In that I just start reading Trump into everything, but I was certainly reading him into that. There was another line. So the essay, the title of the essay collection, Somebody with a Little Hammer, is taken from a story by Chekhov called Gooseberries. And the passage that it's taken from is, it reads at the door. Do people know this Chekhov story, Gooseberries? So at the door of every contented, happy man, somebody should stand with a little hammer, constantly tapping, to remind him that unhappy people exist, however happy he may be, sooner or later life will show him its claws, some calamity will befall him, illness, poverty, loss, and nobody will hear or see, just as he doesn't hear or see others now. But there's nobody with the little hammer. The happy man lives on, and the petty cares of life stir him only slightly, as wind stirs an aspen, and everything is fine. So why did you choose that line for the title of the collection?
I just thought it was the best title.
Honestly. That's a good answer.
I just liked it.
Because when I was reading that, that was another time when I started to think of our man in Washington as both the happy man, but then also sort of unwittingly the guy with the little hammer, reminding people that there's the evidence.
The
I think
his popularity.
Yeah, I mean I think his popularity is showing that, you know, sort of uncovering unwittingly the discontent that surrounds people.
I don't think he's happy. I remember a friend of mine. We were talking about that. He was a friend of mine. Thought he was going to win too because he said Hillary just had no joy in her. Really, and he said, Trump seems like he's like a pig rolling in garbage. He loves it. He rolls and he loves it. You throw him garbage, he eats it, he loves it. And I was like, yeah, but I don't think he's happy. I think there's something, I don't remember the word I used, but there's It says something mad about him to me. He doesn't seem joyous to me at all. He seems devouring,
yeah.
Or eating, yeah, eating constantly. Even will eat anybody he can get in his path, he comes across. I don't think of him in connection with that phrase. But the Norman Mailer, yeah. Norman, I think part of the reason that Trump won is he was really wielding very effectively that kind of old school masculinity that's unpopular in cultured classes. But Norman Mailer embodied it, and it's very uncool now among probably anyone in this room, among people I hang out with usually. But it's a very strong thing for most of the population. And I don't know a woman who could have beat him, frankly. Argue with me if you want. I mean, unless she was a model, I have to say. And I don't know a woman like that who could have been in politics. But I think even though there's been a lot of cultural pushback against that kind of very old school manhood, it's quite a force to be reckoned with. And a lot of people understand it or accept it and feel comforted by it. Like, I wasn't shocked when I learned that women of my generation, white women anyway, voted for him. But trust me, I did not. I think he's repulsive. I don't even think he's strong. But I think to many people he reads as strong because he's using the language of that really old school masculinity. And I think many people feel safe with that. Even people who aren't consciously thinking that, it feels strong and it feels safe. And I think that's the only reason he won, but I think it's a big part of it. And yeah, Mailer embodied that too.
And I don't know, sometimes in reading these old books, these sort of cultural crises that seem new, you realize they're not so much. And I had gone back and read Gooseberries and had come across a line that the character Ivan Ivanovich says, and he's quoting Pushkin, and he says, "The illusion which exalts us is dearer to us than 10,000 truths," which is another that seemed...
Say it again.
"The illusion that exalts us is dearer to us than 10,000 truths."
Yeah, or the illusion that just stuns us.
Yeah.
I think the illusion that Trump is presenting is... it's exalting to some people and stunning in a way. It's hypnotic to some people.
Yeah, and I see that also. I mean, from this kind of question about what is fact now.
Yeah, that's been really weird for me because I when I teach, I sometimes have people read an essay by Vladimir Nabokov, who I heart deeply. But it's called "The Art of Literature and Common Sense," and he talks about how literature and common sense are, in his opinion, completely antithetical. I don't agree with everything he says. It's a more charming piece. It's one of his more lightweight things. But he refers at one time, he says, those fraudulent and farcical figures known as facts. And about how fiction is just about completely playing with that. And metaphors about finding secret connections between things which don't have anything to do with literally what they appear to be. And I love that idea, but it becomes very different if you put it in a political realm. And I've hesitated actually to hand that piece out since the election. Although Hannah Arendt, who I'm not familiar enough with, she's a political philosopher, she coined the phrase "the banality of evil" during the Eichmann trials. And she wrote something that was interesting in that level, talking about the necessity of lying in politics, how it's theater and some lying in politics is inevitable. And some of it, and she even quoted Lincoln and maybe it was Roosevelt lying flagrantly, but to an end of like the exalting, that thing which you just said. But she was making a distinction between that kind of lie and a more pernicious kind, which is meant to really seriously meant to manipulate and deceive people to their detriment. That's too complicated for me to really, I couldn't quite get my head around it, but it was interesting. But I think it's very different to talk about it in terms of writing fiction or art, which does involve, I mean, Nabokov is also known for saying the first fiction writer was the little boy who ran out of the forest screaming, "Wolf, wolf," and there was no wolf. So, I mean, there's truth to that too, but it's really different when you're talking about what's happening now. It makes you want to run screaming to the back to those safe skirts of common sense.
If they still exist. Well, thank you so much. This was so fun. And should we open it up to the...
I have a couple of questions on your process, if I may. One is how your process is different for writing a short story for writing a versus writing a novel. And second, your novels sometimes seem like they have a lot of you in them, particularly the main character and the mayor. And I'm wondering if that's accurate, how you decide sort of where you end and where your fiction begins.
I don't think about it that much. I don't really decide it. The process of short stories and novels, was that the first part of it? I don't really have much of an identifiable process. I've never been confused, though, when I was writing something, whether it was a short story or a novel. It's just, except briefly with Veronica, I wondered if maybe it was a long short story, but not for very long. It's just always kind of obvious to me. I don't really know how to talk about the relationship of myself and my characters. And I mean, sometimes there's a lot of me in my character. Ginger is an odd case. She's the character in The Mayor. And a lot of people just think that she's horrible. And she is kind of based on me just because I did have that experience. I remember showing it to a friend of, not, she wasn't really a friend, she's an acquaintance of mine. Former acquaintance, I might add, but I wanted her to read it because I was halfway done and I was concerned with how I was presenting the mother character of the girl, because this woman was white, but she's a single mother and she had a very rough life and lost custody of her kids at a certain point for that reason. And so I just wanted her to look at it. I didn't explicitly say I want your feedback on this, but she said something that was music to my ears at the time. I said, what did you think of the mother character? And she said, I loved her. Nobody knows what that woman is going through. Everybody thinks she's such a mean bitch, and they don't understand she has to be that way to hold it together and protect her kids. Ginger, I hate it. She thinks she's so great, and she's actually an idiot, and blah, 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 blah. And that's the thing. I think people assume that Ginger is me exactly, and she's not. I mean, Ginger in some ways was harder to write than the girl at sometimes, because she was similar. I mean, demographically, she's me. She's a white woman without children in her, I think she's in her late 40s when it starts and early 50s when it ends. But she's a very different personality. She's very, very, it's a very deep thing in her life that she's not had a child. And it's not something it's not like I've never thought about that or have had feelings about it, but not like her. And also, she is somebody who is kind of doesn't have a grounding focus in her life. So she was hard because in a way she has a lot in common with me, but in another way she's very different. So that was in a way made her hard, really hard to write, because I had to ask myself, what kind of person would not ever really work, because she doesn't have a job. She has worked in her life, but I know women like that who are married to guys at universities who are usually younger than their husbands. She's not a lot younger, but she's like 10 years younger. But sometimes they're 10, 20 years younger, and they stay home and they make wonderful meals for their husband and they travel with them. And they usually do art or something on the side. And they're often really, really nice women. But I couldn't live like that. So it was hard for me to understand her. But people think she's me, for sure.
Some of my favorite essays in your collection were about pop music, and I really loved your writing about music and Veronica as well.
About what?
Pop music.
Oh.
Can you talk a little about the role of music in your life and your approach to writing about it?
Well, I'm glad you like those. The guy who he just mentioned, Sasha Fair Jones, is a music critic primarily, and he was kind of like, the things about music, just don't even look at them. They're not really Talking Heads is not really about the Talking Heads. I just don't look at him even. He liked the thing overall, but he didn't like the music stuff. And I could see why. They're not really properly speaking music criticism. I'm not qualified to criticize music. Music used to play a much bigger role than it does now. I used to listen to music when I wrote, like, a lot. Not at the same time that I was writing. But, like, I would write, like, a paragraph, and I'd get up and put on music and walk around and just space out and listen to it. And it actually, it just made my imagination move. And I was fascinated by music because it's such a different language. And it can do things that you can't do on the page, or, you know, you could do it on the page, but by the time you're at the end of the page, it's like the feeling is not there, and music is like that. So, and it's a more like full body experience to hear things musically. So I was fascinated by it. But also I really loved it as a form. I've kind of lost a little bit of that feeling, partly because I don't have a good sound system. And so I listen to it on the computer, and it's just not the same. But I still listen to it. I mostly listen to stuff. I listen to stuff that's ridiculous. I'm the kind of person that I get obsessed with one song and play it over and over and over. Like, I've had neighbors pound on my wall and hit the ceiling with a broom because they're hearing the same thing over and over. But I've been listening to a Nick Lowe song over and over, Cruel to Be Kind. It's like a great song. So that kind of songs from that era I really like. Graham Parker, Kristen Hirsch, I was obsessed with. Anyway, so I don't know. My relationship to music is... It's definitely a relationship. It's not as powerful as it once was, but I still really enjoy it. I hope that's not too disappointing an answer.
Well, thank you to Mary and to Michael and to all of you for coming.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was novelist, essayist, and short story writer Mary Gaitskill, whose latest book is Somebody with a Little Hammer. She was joined in conversation by Zoetrope All-Story editor Michael Ray. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.